Good afternoon and welcome to the Thursday, June 21st, 2018 regular meeting of the General Plan Advisory Committee. We have a quorum. Is anybody missing? Yes, Melanie is not here today. I think that's the only one missing. We are called to order and we will start with a moment of silence. And now we will do the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, we will start with any announcements from GPAC members. Nothing? No announcements to my left? Okay. You have one? Excellent.
I have one that this may have come from Scott, but on Saturday from 1:30 to 4:30, there's going to be a public open house at the community center to get information about the new water reclamation facility. There will be people there with expertise in several different areas of it, tables where you can ask questions, plenty of time for public comment, and I think for the first time in public, a discussion of possible rate structure that we've been so concerned about. So everybody ought to show up, and this is a chance to really get a lot of good information about the project.
Thank you. We have no presentations. Pass that to Joe. But we do have a few people out in the public. Do we have anybody for public comment?
Good afternoon, Bill Martin, Morro Bay. I noticed that I think it's zoning maps today or zoning, and I just wanted to speak on a couple issues. And the first thing, and I may have mentioned it in the past, but the actual zoning map, I'm talking south of Acacia, it's Special Planning Area B on South Main Street. It's showing, the current map shows approximately two-thirds of the property being commercial and one-third being residential. It's a split zoning or a mixed zoning. The actual zoning is there. It's about 10% of the map is of commercial, and about 90% is residential. And if you're upgrading or doing the zoning maps, I believe it should be changed to make that correction, and that there won't be any confusion in the future. And this has actually been surveyed. I know Scott mentioned as far as surveyed back in 1924. When this property was subdivided, they actually surveyed to the top of the bluff, so the actual survey exists between the residential and the commercial, so it's something that you wouldn't have to resurvey. In the original maps of Morro Bay, you'll see them back in the 70s, and that have the zoning map correct, and for some reason this got supersized on the commercial and shrunk down on the residential. Also, in that same map, it's actually showing some of the water lease site in the zoning for for the commercial zoning. So they've actually even included part of the water lease sites in the zoning map for the waterfront commercial. So just if the opportunity, or maybe this would be the opportunity to kind of fine-tune and correct that map. The other thing I'd like to talk about. Sure.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I wonder, could we make sure we know what piece of property we're talking about? Is there possible to get a map up there? I know we have them all that have maps here, but I don't think we know exactly what we're talking about.
It's mixed-use area B, and this is from Acacia on Main Street. It's approximately a 20-lot subdivision that's on the west side of Main Street down at the southern end.
We're done with public comment.
And it's... but it won't.
I would suggest that you have him finish his public
comment.
Yeah,
we can do that.
We'll address it afterwards.
Okay,
correct.
I apologize.
The other thing I'd want to bring up is on the zoning in the harbor, right now the suggestion is that industrial, commercial, that the entire harbor, the water, is zoned industrial, commercial, and it's everything but the kitchen sink in the entire harbor. In the past, the policy has been south of the boat launch is for recreational boating and recreational fishing. North of the boat launch and up in the northern end, north of Beach Street, has been where all the commercial fishing and all the industrial in the past has been concentrated. Now that's being changed to where what's being proposed is the entire bay, especially where it's very sensitive on the south side. I think you're calling it the Southern District, south of the boat launch, is also being upzoned to the industrial, you know, to allow industrial ships and commercial. And the reason I mention this is in the 60s, even back at that point, there was a tug operation next to the inn at Morro Bay. It was the Stockings. When they went to correct their, or, you know, up, increase their business, I should say, the city required that they had to move to the Embarcadero because that area was starting to become more and more sensitive and more residential. So it's something that I think if you left it where south of the boat launch is more recreational and for fishing and boating, it would be less impact, and the northern area that's always been designated for kind of the heavy commercial and industrial would be in that area. So those are the two things I just want to bring up. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other public comment? No? Do we have comments from our community development director on that?
So that area, and I've said this several times now, since it's been brought up several times, is set by definition. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have survey level accuracy in the GIS maps. We're going to make them as accurate as we can be, but they're still by definition at the top of the bluff. And so you have to have a survey of the individual lots when we go there to determine where that line is. That's what happens with every project that gets developed there. So, yeah, the last now that we bring forward will probably be somewhat more accurate, but again, it's by definition. Where the zones go, and that's the important part. And then we have to determine where the bluff line is on all the properties to see where that line is. And that's where, you know, setbacks are established and things like that. So I understand what Mr. Martin is saying, but it's already addressed, and it's addressed in our current code as well. We have a GIS map that was created off of an old map that was kind of, you know, had the zip tone stuff put on it and that type of thing. And so it was unclear on that map, and then we upgraded it and put it into GIS later on, and it just wasn't exactly accurate with the aerial that's underneath it, which is why it looks that way, and which is why the issue that he raises in relationship to having a piece of the zoning for commercial actually extend what he's saying over the water. What he's basing that on, the underlying aerial in the parcel layer that sits on top of it, is not rectified exactly to it. There's a little bit of error in it, and that's why it looks that way. But we know that it's supposed to be for the land side portion of it, not the water, and it's defined that way.
So Scott, just for clarification, when you say it's by definition, do you mean topographical definition?
The policy that relates to the development there, it describes the area, says the zoning that's residential sits on top of the bluff, and the zoning that's commercial sits below the bluff line. And there's a bluff line. Right. And you determine that by a geologic study that tells you where that is, and that's where the zoning line is split. And so it could be exactly accurate, and we would still require them. We would have to survey the exact line there. The survey was done before, and the survey doesn't match up with the mapping that we have now. I looked at it, so I don't know what the situation was when that was done, or why it doesn't match up. It's unclear to me. But it'll probably continue to be somewhat off, and we'll still continue down the road when we get development on these lots that are split like this to require the provision of a map and a geologic study that identifies that location. If it's pertinent to the development application, it might not be, because there's a bluff there, and at the bottom of the bluff is where the development would go for the commercial portion, and on top of that, typically, is where the development would go for the residential. There are some of those areas over there where they cross over because they're existing developments. So.
And Scott, just common sense would tell me that Mother Nature is going to determine where the bluff is and where it stays or it doesn't stay. That's always going to be moving because of erosion. So wouldn't they have to, when, that's the need for the survey that you're talking about.
So oftentimes, yes, although erosion in this, you know, in the bluffs in these locations are, you know, is not as prevalent as you might have in other places. In fact, we're sort of redefining the bluffs in through this effort because they're not the standard bluffs. And our bluff and standard bluff policies that you get from the Coastal Commission deal with bluffs that are subject to wave action and erosion. These are no longer subject to those forces because these areas have been filled. So they're largely, you know, subject to water runoff would be erosion, and sometimes wind if they're exposed. But those are the two features that are, you know, that are acting to erode the bluffs now. So they're eroding much more slowly than, say, ocean fronting bluffs that you might have in other areas, like where I came from. Before he was here in Pismo, it was a big issue there, less so here.
Okay. Anything else on that? Okay.
So did that answer the question about whether there's commercial zoning back there in the area that he's talking about?
There's the commercial zoning's at the bottom of the bluff.
Oh.
All right, we have nothing on our consent calendar. We have no unfinished business. We have some new business. Our Plan Morro Bay status update.
So we start with most meetings, with the status update. As you're aware, we've released Plan Morro Bay, and we're working on picking up all of the changes to it at this point. And then running it through our planning commission. We are also updating, going through the zoning code process right now. Module 3, so you have Module 4 before you and right now, and Module 3 is at planning commission. It's been stalled there a bit as they've taken on vacation rental issues and issues related to height in the downtown. Those have consumed the discussions at the Planning Commission the last two times that Module 3 was teed up for them to review. Hopefully, our next meeting, they'll be able to take it on and get hopefully through it. Again, it's on their agenda for their next meeting, and hopefully they'll be able to take a good bite out of it, if not get through it entirely. They've had a good long time to sit with it anyway, so they should be ready to go. We're also working on the EIR, and that'll probably be ready for review and may come before this board, hopefully, depending on when it's completed and ready for release. Could be as early as July, but likely it might be not until August. And if it starts getting that late, it might just go to Planning Commission, giving the timeline that we have from the council to complete it. So I'm hoping to be able to bring it to you, though. So depending on when we get it done, that might be next month.
Is Michael Baker doing the EIR? Who's actually doing it?
The Rincon's doing the EIR.
Rincon is, okay.
And I think with that, we'll move on to a presentation from Martha on Module 4.
Thank you. It's good to be back, and I was excited to bring up this slide because, as you can see, we are very well along in the zoning code update. So we went through all the research and reconnaissance, the assessment and diagnostic of your current code, and then we're really at the last of the preliminary drafts of regulations. So after tonight, you've really seen all of the substantive portions of the zoning code. And next, we'll be putting everything together, making revisions, and that will be a complete public review draft of the zoning code, and then it would go through public review again, hearings, and adoption. So we're getting close. The zoning map is under development for the most part. It's in line with the general plan land use designations. We're still working on the overlay districts, which are in some cases dependent on what comes out with the EIR, and so we can't finalize the map until we have that information. So when this is ready, that will be available on the website and distributed for public review. Yep.
And I'll admit I have a personal interest in this question because I did notice that I noticed that if you zero in just a little bit where that yellow and the orange meet sort of south of Morro Bay Boulevard, Mm-hmm. It looks like it cuts some blocks, some of the blocks in half. Where you've got some of the block in the low density or the residential, and some of the same block in sort of this way and this way, mm-hmm. some of the same block in medium density. And I'm just wondering why it didn't follow the streets, the contour of the streets, and just cuts the blocks in half. It just seems a little odd.
Well, I think we'd have to look without kind of going back. I can't give you the exact reason, but these boundaries would follow those from the general plan land use designation, which in a number of cases would actually follow current boundaries as well. So there may be some cases where currently that's where, a boundary is. But I don't know the exact history.
And I will admit also, like I said, it looks like my property is cut in half. It looks a little strange. So...
What area specifically are you looking at?
Oh, like where Estero and Piney meet. There's that block and going all the way up Piney there is like cut in half.
Some of those were done so based on land use and land use patterns that were there. They do mirror the land use map that goes along with those, and so those are the land use map is you reviewed that, and Planning Commission reviewed that, and City
Council
reviewed
that. So can half of a lot be zoned one thing and half of a lot be zoned something else?
Mr. Martin, he gave you a good example of ones that are. We don't have too many of them.
It's just going since that corridor, right along Piney there, that I was wondering why they didn't just. Okay. Anyway, I don't mean to interrupt at an inappropriate time, but I just noticed that it was most of the others do follow streets.
But most of them do, and then even ones when we tried to correct or fix all of the ones that we could. Mm-hmm. In some areas, it wasn't possible, to correct that, and then they remain. So, I don't know exactly where you live. So
yeah, but I mean, it's not just me. It's like that whole. There's about many lots right along Piney where it looks like they're split into two different zones.
I have to go back and look.
Kinds
at
of
it,
zoning. Yeah. It seemed odd. Okay, sorry.
That's okay. I think it was a good point, and we can look back on the parcel basis and see which parcels are split and whether that is intentional or not intentional. So Module 4 includes the overlay districts and the citywide regulations. So the first part, the overlay districts, and what overlay districts are is they regulate areas where there's a modification needed to those base zoning district standards. And typically it's because of specific circumstances, characteristics, or other goals for certain areas. So the overlay districts that are included for Morro Bay are the coastal zone, cultural resource protection, environmentally sensitive habitat, mixed-use residential, planned development, and the waterfront master plan. And I'll kind of go through a summary of each of them. The coastal zone overlay district is really to establish the applicability of the local coastal program. And the majority of Morro Bay is within that area, so it feels a little weird to have an overlay that really covers the entire city except for maybe one or maybe two parcels. But the reason we do the overlay is so that it's known to make sure that it's flagged that a parcel is within the coastal zone. What we heard from people at the beginning of this process is that sometimes that gets overlooked. The need for a coastal development permit gets overlooked. So this is intended to put it front and center that it's each parcel that this is applicable is flagged, and then in this section it identifies when a coastal development permit is required, what is excluded or exempted from the need for the coastal development permit, and then what happens also when, what the process is if you're within a Coastal Commission original permit jurisdiction. And that's where both the Coastal Commission and the city have some permit jurisdiction over it. So this is really in line with the Coastal Act. The second overlay is the Cultural Resource Protection Overlay District, and this applies to areas where there's known to contain or are suspected of containing cultural resources, and that includes anything that's historic, archaeologically sensitive, or paleontologically sensitive. So this is one of the chapters that, or the overlays that, the mapping is really going to depend on what we see in the EI through the environmental review. Typically in Morro Bay, what you'd see most often is the archaeologically sensitive areas. We don't think it's the paleontological resources are significant here, but because the Coastal Commission sees historic, archaeological, and paleontological as cultural resources in need of protection, all of those are covered within this overlay district. So this just has the requirements for, and actually if Kimmy will fix the presentation, requirements if you're in a sensitive area, you'd have a site survey, and if anything's found, there's a mitigation plan that's required. The next overlay is the environmentally sensitive habitat overlay district. You have that in place now. What's occurring through Plan Morro Bay is the updated and more detailed mapping exercises that have been going through. But this overlay applies to areas that are identified as environmentally sensitive habitats, areas within 100 feet of those areas that have been identified, as well as areas that haven't been identified but that are suspected. So in Coastal Commission language, a lot of times this applies to mapped and unmapped environmentally sensitive habitat areas. And the process with this, if you're in the overlay area, you're required to, again, do an initial kind of site survey, and depending on the results of that, there's additional survey work required and then mitigation in protection of that habitat. Depending on the habitat and the value that's found, that mitigation varies. So this is includes the buffers, the process, and identifies the different habitats in line with both the Coastal Act and then the policies that are included in Plan Morro Bay. Next overlay district is the mixed-use residential overlay district, and this is to implement the mixed-use residential in your general plan. So that overlay district in the general plan really kind of treats things differently depending on what that underlying base zoning district is. So when the mixed-use residential overlay district is applied over the visitor-serving commercial area, that allows for residential development up to 27 per units per acre with conditional use permit approval, as long as it's provided as part of a larger visitor-serving mixed-use development. So in a big, in a large coordinated visitor-serving mixed-use development, there is that opportunity for residential development with conditional use permit approval. Whereas where that overlay district is over the neighborhood commercial based zoning district, residential housing types are allowed on the ground floor, or you could do a standalone residential development with conditional use permit approval. So per the base zone, if you're just straight neighborhood commercial, you're required to have, if you do residential, it's required to be on the second floor. Whereas if you're in this overlay district and you do a conditional use permit, you could propose to have either a standalone residential or do a mixed use but have residential on the ground floor. So the next overlay district is planned development. Well, or you could have, like, next to it. You know, you might have some commercial on the ground floor, a small space, but, you know, there's some residential front and back. Exactly. Different configurations. It doesn't necessarily mean your residential then is on the bottom and your commercial is on top. So the next is planned development. And while you currently have a planned development overlay district, this is really a change from that. It has the same name, but it's completely different. So the way your plan development overlay district acts now is that it's proactively applied, and it really just requires a higher level of review for properties where this overlay district is applied. Now, with the revisions to your design review procedures and your permit requirements, that review is essentially happening through those other mechanisms. The design review right now is included with the Planning Commission suggested modifications, applies to residential structures, I believe, over 2,500 square feet. And multi-unit with, I want to say, 6 units, but I'd have to go back and check on that. So this plan development overlay for that additional review really became moot. Allowing us then to use the plan development overlay district how it's traditionally used in just about every other community, where it is a mechanism to propose modification to development standards where you're doing a larger development project that has additional benefits. And the idea is, well, this, what you're proposing is a large development that is appropriate and beneficial to the community, but it doesn't quite fit conventional zoning. So we're going to make some exceptions for that. It's going to go through this additional review. So now, as proposed, the plan development would act as that. It's really a special case that you're not going to see a lot of, particularly in Morro Bay, since it's primarily built out and you don't have a lot of large areas left.
So Martha, just to clarify then, a plan development could literally happen anywhere.
It could happen anywhere, right.
And it comes on a case-by-case basis as an applicant has something that for some reason you believe would be outside of the scope of normal zoning rules, combining or changing the rules, and as part of their application they would apply to be a plan development, or would you decide that? Would we decide that?
They would apply, and right now it has to be a minimum of 1/2 acre in size, although the city council could say, well, you're not a half acre, but we're interested to see that anyway. But they would propose, but it goes through not only, it requires a zone change to have the overlay district applied to it, and then also you're reviewing the specific development plan for that area.
Thank you. Yep. The way it usually works and what it usually looks like is cities will have plan developments, and it'll be plan development 1, plan development 2, and it'll be show up on your zoning map, and that's the way it traditionally looks. Our current plan development ordinance is really used in varying places around town to provide flexibility. It conceptually, this allows you to better fit a project to a site. And so it sort of removed the structure from this and put the flexibility there without any rhyme nor reason about why you might want to use it. And so it didn't seem to be a great thing to maintain, and going to a more traditional form of plan development made sense, which is why we're doing it this way. And then wouldn't it, like Martha said, wouldn't apply to all that many properties. There would have to be properties that would have to put properties together to get the half acre that you would need to actually use it. We don't have a whole lot of properties that are larger than that in town.
But this might, you know, likely apply to the Bank of America property.
Certainly if they redeveloped and they wanted to do something, you know, that didn't, it wasn't necessarily, because that's got that property actually has split land use on it. So this could be a tool if that split made a problem for what they wanted to do there, that they could fit it to the site and through the plan development, you know, flexibility. Yes, they could do something along those lines, but it's a more rigorous process. I mean, you have to go through and change land use, and that's not just through us; that has to go through Coastal too. So I mean, you have to really want it to use it, and so it won't be used as frequently or as sort of flippantly as it might be happen now. I mean, there's not a lot of rhyme or reason as to when we have it, when we use it now.
Scott, I know we have one that's fairly large down contiguous to the George Bailey Park. There, the used to be the old eucalyptus grove on South Main. I think it's at George Bailey Park, the one we just named. Mm-hmm. Do you know if any, off the top of your head, any more examples of PDs that we have in town already?
Well, we have several subdivisions that were in PD, that had PD associated with them, like I think the Cloisters was. So there's various projects have taken advantage of that, and then you have the sort of PD overlay that's on all of the development that happens down on the waterfront. we sort of gone away from it because the application, there's no rhyme nor reason to it really when you look at it. It's not consistently applied throughout the city, and so we went away from that and say, hey, let's use it for these situations and just make our development standards apply to these other areas and then follow that process for those. And so this actually makes more sense from a PD standpoint. Yeah. It's people coming here from other areas would not understand the way our PD is used. Like, I worked in the Central Valley for a little while, and we had PDs 1 through 50. You know, and every time we went to a new one, you just added another number, and it would be 53, and that's, you would change your zoning, and the map would change and reflect that. So.
So the final overlay is the waterfront master plan overlay, and that's really just to identify the applicability of the waterfront master plan and provide that cross-reference to it that applies.
Quick question on that one, too. You're referring to the master plan that is currently in existence from the late 90s? Is that
right.
What we mean? Okay.
So the next group of regulations are the citywide regulations, and these are regulations that apply in all districts throughout the city unless it's specifically stated otherwise, and includes requirements for specific regulatory programs such as the affordable housing density bonus and things such as that. And I'll kind of go through a summary of the highlights of each one of them. So the first is visual resource protection, and of course, that's an important goal of Morro Bay, as well as in the Coastal Act, the visual resource protection. What happened when we developed the zone district standards, a lot of that addressed these types of issues, the height, the bulk, the setbacks, types of issues. So these are kind of the more overarching requirements, the standards for it, as well as provides the cross-references and identifies the scenic areas, the viewpoints and scenic views identified in the general plan. So having specific standards for that. But the real kind of quantifiable standards were all incorporated into the district standards. And these really require minimizing alterations to landforms, being compatible with character, enhancing visual quality, and so on. A lot of this is based on your current standards in your code. The next section is affordable housing, density bonuses, and other incentives. This carries forward your existing section. It's updated for consistency with the state density bonus law and your housing element, so bringing it all in alignment and consistency. The next section is hazards and shoreline protection, and this includes the standards that's applicable to development in hazard areas. So that includes shorelines, geologic hazards, fire hazards, and so on. I would say there's two kind of major changes. One, this has been updated to reflect sea level rise, which is something that has been kind of more recent in the Coastal Commission, what they've been looking at, incorporating and addressing through local coastal programs. It also includes, as Scott mentioned, a distinction between coastal bluffs and non-coastal bluffs. So right now, one thing that Morro Bay experiences is coastal will see your bluffs as all coastal bluffs, whereas in fact you have some bluffs that are nowhere near the coast, and so they don't have those, regulations aren't appropriate for them. You're not dealing with seawalls on them. It's really actually can be okay to have development on theirs because they're not the coastal bluffs. They're really almost hillsides between the two. So that clarity and definition is included, as well as some standards for development on sloping lots. And that's to address kind of that visual impact of development. You know, if you have, right now your height is measured from average natural grade, and if you have a sloping lot and you take the highest point and the lowest point and measure height from the midpoint, you end up with one really tall side and one really short side. So there's been some standards included for the maximum height of a single building elevation for 20 feet. And that's really to encourage stepping, you know, stepping in lower heights. The next section on landscaping. So this establishes the general landscaping standards, when you need to put in landscaping, what needs to be landscaped, what areas of your property. It's also brings, it's updated consistent with the state's model water efficient landscape ordinance. So when the state put out their water efficient landscape ordinance, it's very complex, and there's actually a lot of calculations within it. You have to find out your evirotranspiration rate, your applied water, your estimated applied water. And in my mind, when something requires calculations, it really kind of kills the effectiveness of it on a day-to-day basis, right? So what's included in here is some different options. So you can choose different plant options. So if you plant all low water using plants, we know that you're going to be below your maximum applied water allowance. If you have certain combinations of that, we know that you're still going to be below your water allowance. So you can choose one of those options. If you want to be creative with your landscaping and have all kinds of freedom, that's fine as well, but then you are required to do that calculation to make sure that you're not using more water than you're allowed through the state ordinance.
I have a question. So this would be mostly mostly applicable to new development, I'm assuming. That we can, because is there any control over what people do once you move into a house or have an apartment or duplex or any of those things? Is there really monitoring of changes in landscaping if something dies and they replace it with something that uses more water or something like that? There's no permitting. Is there permitting involved, or how does that carry forward?
So this would, as you see on the board, it could apply to additions greater than 10% of floor area. So we would add conditions. We have nothing that requires you to have landscaping say single family homes and those types of things. This would change that. We have a lot of homes around town that have no landscaping. Maybe not the most attractive thing for a neighborhood. Or it's all paved. Again, maybe not the most attractive thing for a neighborhood. Creates runoff issues and things like that as well. So this is an idea to have some landscaping required as an association with the development that's taking place. Moderate, I mean, it's not a lot, mm-hmm. But at least we could have some. And so for similarly to how when we approve a house and it's got a color palette and somebody paints their house, but not say you have to go back and put that other color back on it. So landscaping, they put it in, we go out and evaluate it and final the project, then that's kind of where it stops. We don't do enforcement of landscaping.
I also did wonder about that, because I've sat through several things at the Planning Commission where they have approved things for certain colors, and I have often thought, does anybody actually go back and tell people they can't paint their house a certain color? I've never heard of anything like that here.
Our policies don't extend that far. Some cities have that, and some lock that in for commercial development. I've seen that.
I've seen it for commercial development, and also in certain places we have a homeowners association or some place where it's the CC&Rs, for example.
Correct.
That you're allowed.
Yeah, which is something.
But there's not too much of that around here.
Yeah, the city doesn't enforce CC&Rs.
Right. And so what you're saying is you try and do what you can when they're making these changes, but if somebody goes back later and does some other thing, there's not really any mechanism to.
The policy is not written to go and enforce that on single family homes, nor do we have staff really to do that. We realize we have a hole in our ordinance that doesn't deal with this, and uh-huh. So we wanted a landscaping ordinance, so we had some ability to do that. Other than than having it a one-off every time we go to Planning Commission, and they maybe they want it, maybe they don't want it. It's not,
yeah,
it's
no,
not,
no.
It's
it
not
makes,
consistently
this
applied.
This is way better, because sometimes it almost has seemed arbitrary when people said, well, I don't like that color, and I don't like, you know, some, it's the opinion of the people on the commission, and this is better to have a written standard. Mm-hmm. But still, it would be something that would be approved at the time, but not necessarily enforced or monitored.
I have
you'd hope that they would continue it, but you can't. You're not really enforcing that.
Not so. The way the ordinance is written now. No, there's not an enforcement requirement, or that we don't condition project that you keep it that way forever.
Right. Okay.
I mean, the city could lock those things down if it became a desire of the community. It's just I've never heard that expressed, and we haven't.
Yeah,
even
I haven't either. That's why I was wondering about
at this
it.
Point,
so, okay.
This is more baby steps than you know, than wholesale changes. It's just realizing that, you know, there's been a desire, you know, expressed throughout this entire process of updating general plan and LCP, you know, toward beautification of the city, to make it look better, right? I mean, you've all heard this throughout all of the outreach we've done. This is a step toward that, right?
Yeah. No. So I think it's a good step. I just was curious about what happened later. So, but thank you for the clarification.
Scott, on the same lines, page 49 of that landscaping, the Your PowerPoint covers the first two applicable, or the three, the first two, yeah, A and B, the 10% or more. But the C, all new and rehabilitated landscaping projects that include new irrigated landscaping over 500 square feet. Is that just a standalone landscape project you're referring
State
to?
Law.
Because
part of the model landscape ordinance that Martha referred to, that's passed by the state. We're required to follow it. That's why it's in
there. My question is, how would, again, that's basically unenforceable, because no one's going to come for a permit for landscaping because there's no requirement. So,
except everybody complains to us about everything people do.
Right. So,
so anytime somebody, so what happens if somebody's doing a major, you know, change out of landscaping and they didn't come talk to us? How we would find out about it is someone would call us. If their laborers didn't call them and they were good, then yeah, we would have no way. We don't have landscape police. But if it came to us, we would go, yeah, you need to comply with this, and we would bring them into the ordinance, because that's the law. We don't have the ability not to enforce it, really.
So this would, then would I assume this would be a reactive code enforcement complaint then?
I don't know how it could be anything else. I mean, it would come with projects, right?
Right.
But then if somebody was just redoing their landscaping, people do that all the time. I'm in the process of doing it right now at my house, and so then you have to comply with the requirement. And would we know necessarily? No, it's not unlike people building things without permits. Although we regularly complain about that too. So that a lot of that stuff does come to our attention when people are doing things. People want to know whether it's okay or not. Yeah. So
I like this, because I mean we all should be doing our part to conserve the water and getting down to less water, but just kind of wanted to hear you in public venue to say that it's really no staff to do this right now.
Well, I mean, we would have to be driving around the city all day long with code enforcement officers. doing that. We don't have,
and that's why I said the difference between reactive and proactive code enforcement.
It could be a little bit of both, though. I mean, because they do drive around town most of the day. They spend most of their day time out in the field, but usually it's in doing investigations. If they were to, they oftentimes see things happening at properties, and then that starts a new code enforcement case. While they're out, they don't close their eyes. So.
And then I would add, occasionally we see at the counter someone will come in for a single-family alteration permit, and they may be doing a hodgepodge of things that require a building permit. And then they'll say, oh, and I'm also going to be redoing the landscaping, and I need to do, you know, maybe they're upgrading their plumbing too or something like that. And so staff does ask, is it more than 500 square feet? Usually no, because that's a large amount of area. But if it was yes, then our new code would say, okay, well, in current, well, actually it's state law, so we would currently say, show us that it's compliant with this state water landscape ordinance.
Would we be able to give them, suppose they are under the 500 square feet but want to be a good citizen and conserve water, would we have a handout that we could give them to help them guide them in that process, or would they have to go out and secure the services of a landscape architect?
So if they wanted to do something, we do advise them. I mean, there are websites out there. You go to I think slowwaterwiselandscaping.com. There's all sorts of great ideas on how you can plant drought-tolerant landscaping. The state website has the calculation worksheet on how to determine your water allowance and your estimated water use. So it's math. It's not completely impossible to do it yourself.
But and the intention through this of offering those different options for compliance is to make it just very easy for people to comply with it, and by planting all low water using plants, then you do comply and you don't need to do the extra calculations and the follow-up. So the next section is non-conforming uses, structures, and lots. So this is the rules that apply for things that were legally established or legally built at the time, complied with all the rules and regulations in place, but now maybe don't follow the current rules and regulations. Maybe the rules have changed, setbacks have changed, heights regulations have changed, so on. So one of the things that we heard repeatedly as we talked to people at the beginning of this process was that one thing that they valued about Morro Bay so much was that it was eclectic and funky and different, and really wanted to hold on to some of the older development rather than, you know, whenever possible, having things torn down and rebuilt. And one of the things that your existing non-conforming provisions were, in some cases, actually encouraging things to be torn down and rebuilt. You were limited in the amount that that could be expanded if you had a non-conforming structure, and there was additional processes to go through. So this, what's drafted in Module 4 includes some changes to that. So one of that would, currently there's a 25% limit to additions to non-conforming structures. And in order to get that 25%, it also requires Planning Commission approval. The proposal is to allow for alterations and additions to non-conforming structures as long as that addition or alteration conforms. So you can keep the non-conforming portion of it. You don't need to get rid of that, but you can't make it more non-conforming. But you could put something on there that does conform. So whatever your addition is, that needs to conform, but you can leave the non-conforming there. The only exception to that is in residential districts. If you have a non-conforming interior or rear yard setback, you could continue that on the first floor. You can't encroach further into it, but you don't have to, you know, if your house goes like this, you don't have to jog in 2 feet and then continue back to meet, you know, the new setback or so on to be conforming. So that's really to, you know, recognize that sometimes older homes or maybe structures are smaller than maybe what people need or want some additions to, and to allow them to keep what's there and provide for changing conditions. Along with that, right now there's a limit on expansion of non-conforming uses, and currently there's an allowance for a one-time 10% expansion of a non-conforming use with Planning Commission approval. Well, the proposal is to still require a Planning Commission approval for an expansion of a non-conforming use, but take out that hard and fast limit to it. So the Planning Commission could decide what the appropriate amount of expansion is, and it includes some findings that the Planning Commission would need to make on, you know, that it's not detrimental to public health, safety, and welfare, that it's, you know, not inconsistent with the general plan, that basically it's compatible with the area it's in. And that's really in recognition of sometimes there's non-conforming uses that actually are benign or, you know, great in a neighborhood. We think of an old traditional maybe corner store that's in a residential neighborhood. Well, that sometimes is the, you know, that heart of the community or the residential area. So this changes to really, you know, recognize that maybe not all non-conforming uses are bad and need to be gotten rid of, and that the Planning Commission could be able to make that determination through a public process.
I like this section, this whole discussion here, because I was a little concerned when we talked about neighborhood design guidelines and things like that, that we were getting, having come from a place where there were subdivisions and CC&Rs and things where you could only do certain things, paint your house a certain color and that sort of thing, that we would lose, and the setback rules and that kind of thing, that we would lose some of the funkiness here, because you things had to be all the same as the other houses on the street or things, the materials and all that. So I'm actually really happy to see at least some flexibility here. 10% of a structure, a lot of the times they're nonconforming because they're so little or they're, you know, in the wrong place or something, and that's very, very restrictive. So I'm happy to see some of these things preserved as long as the new things that are added are up to code and conforming, right, and all that. I'm glad we're looking to preserve some of that unusualness that's there for some of the existing. I mean, sometimes things are eyesores, and honestly, right, they really are. But a lot of times, I think it's it is part of the uniqueness of this place that we do try and preserve those things. And I'm really happy to see this.
So on a subject we've talked about the last few meetings, at least I've brought up as far as the affordable housing and the. Marketing or urging people to look at converting garages to affordable, to a second accessory dwellings. Would this be a vehicle then that someone, if they had a garage that was non-conforming as far as setbacks and stuff, could use this vehicle to expand it and turn it into an accessory dwelling unit or not?
It's already allowed by state law. You can convert a garage even if it's non-conforming, and you don't have to make the garage setback conforming to an ADU. It's okay. Memorialized in our ordinance now, or it would be in the draft. I mean, but yes, okay. That's the requirement. Something we don't have discretion over anymore.
Perfect. I'm just trying to sell those garage conversions, trying to increase our affordable housing stock. You know,
the state had the same idea.
Yeah. They're say we have a housing crisis, not a parking crisis. Quote we've gotten from them. That is kind of predicated on where you live, though.
So otherwise, this section has provisions of, you know, basically you can continue a non-conforming use or a structure. It has, you know, if it's vacant or abandoned for a period of 6 months or more, then that you lose that non-conformity. And any new use would need to be in conformance with the current requirements. Then it also has provisions in, you know, where there's damage of, you know, due to, you know, fire, earthquake, or so on, the provisions for when it can be restored or replaced.
So to repeat that, if you have a non-conforming property and you sell it, the non-conformancy goes with the property, not with the owner, right?
Correct.
So, but if it's abandoned, then a new owner would not get that non-conformance. They would have to bring it up to
abandoned. If it's a non-conforming use and it's abandoned for 6 months, then you would lose that use and wouldn't be able to reestablish it. So, if it was a business of some sort in a neighborhood and it stopped for that 6 month period that wasn't allowed there, then if somebody came in and bought the building and said, oh, I'd like to keep doing that, I'm going to use the same sign, you know, keep being whatever that use is, we would say, no, you can't, because you've lost the nonconformity.
What if the same owner came back?
Six-month time period. It's just related to the use. It doesn't matter who's operating it.
Okay.
It's completely fine to transfer it. You can transfer it. It doesn't change on sale or anything.
As long as
it continues to operate or doesn't discontinue for more than 6 months, okay, you can continue it forward.
Okay, there's a number of changes with parking, and some of it is also based on what we heard of encouraging reuse, investment and reinvestment in existing structures and with existing businesses. Another thing that we always think about is, you know, looking forward. You know, is the parking kind of demand going to be, and what does our circulation and mobility network look like? And I think one thing to remember is that regardless of what happens with the parking, requirements. These are minimum requirements. And parking doesn't disappear overnight. So even if a parking requirement changes, that doesn't mean actual parking that's there on the ground necessarily disappears. I think that's one thing when people think, oh, parking requirements are lowered, there's not going to be any parking. Well, there's a, you know, a whole process of time that happens in development. So I'm going to highlight a couple of the changes. The first is, I would say, really kind of a clarity in that when parking is required. So with new buildings and new land uses, that's kind of easy. You need to provide the required parking. When you have a change in use or an expansion of a use, you're required to provide parking for that increase. And not, you don't need to go back and provide it for the entire building or the site. So if they had, you know, five parking spaces and you come in and you're required, and that's what they were required, and your business comes in and you're required to have six, you only need to provide that other one, so for a total of six. Whereas if they were required to have five, but they only had two, they were legal nonconforming to that, and now I'm required to have six, I still only need to provide that one more. So you just have to provide it for that increase that you're causing, either through that change of use or through that addition. Additionally, right now in your neighborhood commercial district, there is an exception that from a change of use from a commercial use to any other commercial use, you don't need to provide additional parking. So in your neighborhood commercial district right now, you can take any commercial use, replace it with another commercial use, and you don't have to provide additional parking. So that's proposed to extend to all commercial uses. I'll talk about the proposed parking ratios, but with the adjustments to the parking ratios, where that really has the biggest effect is in whether you're changing something from retail to restaurant. So those are both commercial uses, but they have different parking requirements. So this would allow you to switch out without providing additional parking.
Okay, so what's the rationale if you're putting in a new use that does normally require more parking, what's the rationale for not requiring the additional parking?
Well, one is to, you know, encourage tenancy to, you know, and provide that flexibility for businesses to move in. Another part of it is typically these would be in areas that are commercial, and you'll have kind of a flow of different times and amounts of uses anyway. So even if I'm a retail shop, but my customers happen to come, you know, in the morning constantly, that is going to, wait, let me see how I can articulate this a little bit better. Just because you're the same use and you're required to, you have the same parking requirement, that doesn't mean your parking characteristics are always the same. There's a lot about parking that we don't know. So even though a restaurant may require more parking, it doesn't mean that it was the parking impact at any given time is more.
Well, that's true, but let's say you put a new restaurant versus a restaurant converting from something else. Okay, the new restaurant would have to provide parking as a restaurant in all of the required spaces, whereas the restaurant converting from the something else would not have to do that, right?
Is that they would have to maintain the parking that was there.
Right, but they wouldn't have to put in enough parking, I mean, compared to, say, a new restaurant or a new use.
In a new building, right.
In a new building. Yeah. I'm not sure I think that's logical.
Yeah. Well, and also when you're building a new building, right, you have a whole site that you can work on.
Okay.
So if you're going into an existing building, again, and encouraging that reuse of existing buildings and reinvestment,
I think in this town the parking thing is a challenge because there it really isn't a place to say you have to put the parking. There, you know, if you tell, say, somebody on Morro Bay Boulevard, well, you really need six spaces, there aren't six spaces. There may be two in front of their store, and that's kind of it. And I look at, even with related to the number of spaces and the size of the building, I have a teeny tiny little store, but it can be packed with 20 people at once, whereas the huge building next door may have one or two customers walking through.
Right, but we're talking neighborhood commercial, right? We're not.
This would be for commercial uses citywide.
Commercial,
so
yeah.
Currently it is neighborhood commercial, but.
And I can also see if a restaurant comes in, for example, that's mostly a dinner restaurant and the stores all close at 5, then your parking isn't as much of a problem for that. Whereas if they're open for lunch, it may be.
Right, but in this case, it's if they were open for lunch, they are going to get the same waiver as a dinner restaurant under these new rules.
Mm-hmm.
So it could actually make it worse.
Mm-hmm.
So that's I'm just not sure I'm 100% comfortable with that.
So, Martha, is the reason for the changes that you're talking about to make it easier for people to change the kind of business that operates at a location? Is that the point of it? To attract new businesses?
There's a couple of reasons behind this. Yeah. And it has to do with, the city's, like Martha mentioned this, the city's mostly built out, right? And so our commercial areas mostly have the buildings that they have, and a lot of them don't have the parking that they need. And then so a new business comes in and wants to locate in one of the buildings, and we have to do these crazy gymnastics to get them in there. We realized this on North Main, and we passed an ordinance that changed it and just said commercial users can go in and out here, no change, and it doesn't matter. Just go in, make it happen, because we were starting to get vacancies there, and we weren't able to put new businesses in there because they had parking from way back when they were built, 50 years ago in many cases. So they didn't have parking, that was consistent with our current requirements, and so they would come in and want to establish a new use, and we're like, well, your parking requirement's X, and they couldn't come in. What'll happen even in the downtown is somebody will come in and change out their retail store and want to do restaurant. And we're like, okay, you can do that, and you're either going to pay us an in lieu fee. Right now that is suspended or sort of suspended, and we have a minimal fee to it. But it was $15,000 a space. And so basically if you required to have a few of those, that was all the money they had to come in and redo the space. And so it stopped turnover of those buildings, and it stopped upgrades to those buildings. And then sometimes we make them create kind of strange floor plans where, okay, you can create that, you can use that space, but there was a retail use in there, and that had X number of parking spaces, so your seating area for your restaurant can only be this big. And they're like, okay, and they would come in, and you get some kind of weird configuration that doesn't work, and then we have to monitor it over time because that's not a sustainable, seating area for a restaurant. And they have mission creep, and now they got tables outside, and now they're doing whatever, which isn't bad. We want the restaurant to be successful, but we're forcing them into the box, and it didn't make sense. And we were doing this time after time, and really what we were doing is turning people away. They're like, I can't pay $30,000, I can't pay $60,000 to do that. So we had a disincentive built into our ordinance for commercial occupancy in our town, and that's what we're trying to resolve. It's creating a problem. If it becomes a problem going the other way, we'll see it just like we see it now, just like we saw the problem with our current ordinances, and we'll be able to address it, and maybe we'll change it. But right now, we have this identified disincentive to change out commercial businesses in the city, and we have to fix that. So this is an economic development tool.
Yeah, and it makes really good sense. And I think the only thing I'd add to it is it'd be nice to have it just said here just like that somewhere. So when people read these things, I understand, why is this change coming through?
I think that I think that last statement is an excellent point, in that perception is everything, and people don't typically delve very deeply into these matters, and they'll simply say, "What a small store is switching to a larger restaurant, and we should be able to explain, or they should be able to see the explanation before the right."
I think that should really apply throughout the whole plan. I don't want to put a bunch more work on you, but I have a question on page 65, the table on the required number of parking spaces. For single family, it says 2 per unit. On lots greater than 4,000 square feet in size, a minimum of 1 parking space shall be covered. I seem to remember, and I think it was our first year, that we kind of tossed this around, and I think there was maybe some support to see about relaxing the need for any covered parking spaces at all, again, based on this affordable housing concept of converting a garage to an accessory dwelling unit. So did we abandon that, or are we not, we can't do it, or why is it in there?
Martha loves this, by the way, and I'll let her speak to that in a minute. So the ADU thing that you bring up, so you can convert your garage and you're not required to an ADU, and you're not required to replace the garage. We'll require you to place the spaces that were supposed to be there, so you have to put them outside somewhere on the lot. They can be in a setback, whatever. And that's picked up in state law as well. That's a requirement. We can't require them to put a new garage back once it's been converted to an ADU. So there's that component of it. In general, on the smaller, when we started getting into the smaller lots, that's where this specific concept came from. I think, what was it before? Because I had her change it back. What was it before?
I had no covered.
Yeah, I had no covered parking for any of the residential sizes. So
and that's what I remembered was, and it just seems like I hear your logic on the ADU, but if someone is not doing an ADU and they're required to have one space, that seems to be a little bit onerous restriction on them when the other person gets a little free ride. I just thought we were moving towards a requirement of no covered parking spaces in residential zones, single family.
So the concerns and the reason I had Martha change it back was largely based on commentary that came out of the Planning Commission. When we've got on larger lots, you know, the concern is larger lots, bigger houses, more folks with more stuff. Where's all that going? That usually takes place when we're doing additions and those types of things, and that conversation has been fairly prevalent at the Planning Commission level. And so my opinion was that we were going to run into an issue there. So I said, well, we get for smaller lots, fine. I mean, I don't think it's really much of an issue. I think it's fine if they park outside, it's okay. But when we got to the larger ones, it seemed to make sense that the garages were provided, or covered parking was provided. I don't have a particular love for garages, so it was really more driven by that. So if you have designs elsewhere, please state so.
Well, you're setting up an obvious situation for failure. You're going to zoning code, building codes, code enforcement requires a garage to be accessible for two cars. We don't go around and enforce that, but if someone complains and said and sends a complaint to you, you have to go and send a code enforcement officer out and say you got to make that garage available for vehicles. Now, and you're telling me that Planning Commission had an angst against bigger properties and they want that garage there, but if I heard you correctly, you said they want the garage there so people can fill it full of crap. So that seems like you're not following the letter of the law there. I mean, if you're going to make them have a two-car garage, we should make them have it available for the cars and not for storage, and they should find another way to store things.
Well, we're not making them have a garage.
No, it's a covered parking space, like a carport.
Well, I understand, but even that, I just have a... I don't like it, so...
I'd be interested to hear what you say. This is a great conversation, by the way.
I apologize if this is a stupid question. I have a personal preference for covered parking because I don't like going out in the rain, but that's my personal preference. What is the policy reason for covered parking? I mean... Garages as opposed to just a place to put your car, what is the policy reason for why it must be covered?
It's I think it's legacy more than anything else. I mean,
and in fact, a larger home.
Our existing codes were developed back, you know, in the time frame where the car was king, right? It's still pretty big, but I think we're moving away from car-centric things and trying to get away from them now. That seems to be the general idea. So.
I like driving in with my garage, but that's just me. It doesn't mean that it would rise to the level of a policy prescription. And also, you expect if somebody is putting a house addition on or have more, they have more room in their house for their crab, you know. But they don't necessarily need a garage for it. So, I mean, whatever it is. Now, if you want to say that boats have to be whatever because they're tall, or you know, that's a different kind of issue. But you're just talking about regular cars. you know, if it's out in the open or not, I may have, again, a visual preference for, I don't want to look at your car, but that's just a more of a personal thing, I think, than a policy prescription.
Yeah, and if you don't care, we can remove it and continue it forward. Like I said, Martha would be very happy right now. Something along, I have a mission to get rid of garages or something like that. I don't know. It was a comment. So
and actually, just so I can kind of wrap the complete story, too, because that is something that we did hear a lot from the beginning, again, with people saying, so. And I also want to get into when additional parking is required for new residential, because what we're hearing is, you know, I want to do an addition to my house, but then now I need to, I have a single car garage, now I have to do a two car garage, but we like to have small homes, but now I have to build this big garage. How does this make sense? So what's also included here is for if you're non-conform, or for residential parking, you only need to provide additional parking when a new dwelling unit is constructed. So say you have an existing non-conforming single family home with one, with a single car garage, which today would be non-conforming. If you did that addition, you wouldn't need to provide another parking space unless you were creating a new dwelling unit.
Well, and again, now I'm going to kind of go the other direction and say, well, wait a minute. If you take a one-bedroom house and you make it a four-bedroom house, okay, you would might logically think that perhaps more people might live there. That's not always true, but more people might live there. So, again, I'm not saying it has to be covered parking, but it kind of makes sense that you have, you know, a large expansion. You would have, even if it's not a separate unit anymore, if it's a significant expansion, that you would have to have some additional area for parking off the street. So I'm kind of going the other way, and I'm not saying there has to be, you know, a six-car garage or
right,
something
right.
like that, but some additional place to put cars with a much larger home does seem appropriate.
Okay, and that's just the straight kind of parking requirement. And typically, parking spaces for residential isn't tied to square footage. It's for single family, it's per unit. So even if, you know, somebody did build a two-bedroom versus a four-bedroom, typically you don't have different parking requirements. As far as the covered versus non-covered, so what a lot of places are doing now is, and as Scott said, you know, this two-car garage, requiring a two-car garage for every single family home is kind of legacy. It all happened at one time. And now that in more recent updates that people are doing are getting rid of that requirement for covered parking, in recognition of a couple of things. Number one, trying to control the scale of homes and also that appearance that a garage makes, you know, to the streetscape. And when we talked to people again at the beginning of this process, we did ask that particular question, you know, does parking need to be covered? And there was agreement kind of across the board from everyone that we talked to that on small lots, no. Those are constrained already anyway. It makes things funky. You end up, all you see is garage. On the larger lots, that really varied. And because some people are of the opinion still that cars, you know, should be put in garages, and others say, you know, no one uses their garages to park their cars anyway, so why are we requiring them to do it when they're not going to do it? If somebody chooses to build a garage and park their car in it, they always can. If they choose to build a garage and put storage in it, they always can, but you need to provide those parking spaces. So as Scott said, it's kind of a policy call for the city, and I think people just have opinions and reasons one way or the other.
So here's another reason why I'd be in favor of removing the requirement for covered parking altogether. And I tie this to our landscaping and our water conservation. So someone doesn't have to do any covered parking. They could, if they choose, install permeable paving and reduce the amount of water leaving the property and thereby conserving some water also at the same time. So it would give them that option to be able to do that and conserve water.
You know, I'm trying to recall some of the discussions about the garages, but I'm having some difficulty. I do recall mention of the cost associated with building of garages, which is surprisingly high, and in the interest of a more affordable housing inventory, certainly reducing the number of covered structures is significant. On the other side of the argument is those. for me personally is just the aesthetics of seeing cars. I consider cars a blight on the environment, and I've said it often enough. But then again, covered parking doesn't particularly obscure the cars.
And one of the things we're seeking to resolve is, and you'll appreciate this, is we constantly come to the Planning Commission with parking exceptions. When we couldn't put the parking, you know, in a garage in a covered situation, I mean, half of your, I mean, like just about every other Planning Commission meeting that you have one of these things that comes forward. It's just, it's kind of ridiculous. So we're trying to remove that, those types of things, one, from going through the process and going to Planning Commission, because you don't really need to see those things, but the policy requires you to. And then getting rid of the issue entirely for where we see them the most, which is on lots that are smaller than 4,000 square foot. We just need to get rid of that because there's no reason why we keep doing that. It takes a lot of staff time to do it, and then Planning Commission gets it, and largely you're kind of like, okay, it looks fine. You know, I mean, there's not a whole lot to say about whatever small addition they happen to be doing to the house. It's just we have to go to Planning Commission to get your okay because it's a parking exception because it doesn't comply. It just sort of seems to clog up the agendas unnecessarily, really, and with something that should be a staff level decision, really. So
it seems like that what we're getting toward is a policy that would say for affordability, recognizing that we have small lots, smaller than 4,000 square feet in North Morro Bay especially, and that the cost is high, that our policy should be to simply require off-street parking and let it go at that.
So are you comfortable with that? So we'll be happy to, I mean, we can absolutely just eliminate the limitation, which is the 4,000 square foot where we were going to that, so.
You know, one thing.
Correct.
Yeah.
For any size, yeah, we're just going to get rid of the requirement.
You know, one thing I was surprised to read in here was that driveways had to be concrete or asphalt, because it just seemed like there's been so much talk lately about making permeable surfaces.
You can have permeable pavers, that's fine.
But in here it said that that's what they would be. I can't remember reading somewhere where it was parking driveways. Driveways would be concrete or
pages
asphalt.
On that?
I can't remember where it is now.
Does paving, pavers, and stepping stones, those things count as concrete? Maybe if they were made out.
We count them normally. I don't know if this is language left over from our current ordinance or what it is.
I have read it before. I don't know.
So it's on page
76. Or alternative surface, yeah. So it's fine. Or alternative surface. So, yeah, we regularly encourage use of permeable pavers in areas where they're appropriate. Some areas in town, they're not, because water won't drain through them and go anywhere.
Okay, so I understand as far as alternative surface approved by the city engineer, and I'm going to use my driveway for example, so it exceeded 16%, so it required concrete paving. That's engineering standards. But could it be reworded to say driveways with less than 16% slope can use alternative paving or asphalt? Reword that so people don't have to go to the city engineer and get approval for permeable paving on a flat driveway. If it's a flat lot, there's no really angst there, I think. No. I'm talking right here. Surfacing, asphalt or concrete, or alternative surface approved by the city engineer.
We can just get rid of the.
No, that's turnarounds. Yeah. No, there's a requirement.
Anybody that takes over 200 square feet is going to get a building.
And it's a good deal because it's asphalt slip.
So as I say, maybe we get rid of the engineer piece of it, and we just say the city, because you're already required for doing your paving anything over 200 square feet to get a building. Doesn't necessarily need to be approved by the city engineer.
I'm just looking at being, you know, user-friendly to the customers and not having to run them through another hoop.
I mean, we can remove the engineer piece and it could just be through the city. You're required to get a building permit for paving over 200 square feet. So.
Okay.
Well, the paved wheel tracks are really ugly, but
no Hollywood drives
functional.
For you, huh?
So I'm going to skip back to the required parking spaces. So for the minimum number of parking spaces required, so one of the things that's incorporated here is for the waterfront district. No on-site parking is required, and that's kind of in recognition or our attempt to reconcile what happens in the waterfront district with the calculation of historic parking credits, and that being really kind of an unclear process number allocation, and what it typically resulted in was not requiring any parking because there were some historic parking credits that seemed to account for any parking that would need to be required. So this, the idea with this is just to be more transparent in what was actually happening through the process. In other districts, however, you're required the minimum to provide the minimum number of parking spaces per the table. And the parking requirements for each use were kind of evaluated and revised to a large extent to try and come up with, wherever appropriate, a consistent parking requirement. And so you'll see, so for public and semi-public uses, for all of those groups of uses, it's one per 250 square feet of floor area, except as specified. So we call out the uses that have particular characteristics that warrant having different standards. But wherever possible, we want to have a consistent parking requirement, again, so that as these different uses maybe come in or switch out, staff and the applicant and the interested parties aren't constantly trying to recalculate parking and trying to figure it out, when in actuality, the difference sometimes is maybe just a couple that really wouldn't have a significant, you know, effect on the operation of, you know, the area and circulation together. So, again, wherever possible, trying to have consistent parking requirements.
Although, with given what the conversation we had before, where if you convert from something else, you just keep the same regulations, this is really only going to be very limited to just brand new buildings, right?
Right.
Pretty much.
And that's also where I identify, by virtue of this, switching out uses, they predominantly have the same parking requirements anyway, particularly for commercial, where really the difference is going to be that the retail to restaurant, the noticeable difference.
My argument here would be, but the last thing we want on waterfront lease sites is parking spaces. I mean, it for many, many reasons, but there's, you know, a lot of pedestrians walking around down there. It's not a good look. You don't want cars there. It needs to be a lot. It needs to be more pedestrian than it is now. I mean, which is what our planning efforts to this point have largely been focused at in that area. And hopefully, when we're done with all this, we can start implementing some of those things to make it more pedestrian friendly.
Martha, on page 67, continuation of commercial uses from page 66. You're giving examples, and you have short-term vacation rental. So if I'm reading this correctly, then that's specific to short-term vacation rentals in commercial districts only. Would that be right?
No, actually, and that actually now reminds me of something.
Should that be
moved? Clarify, but no, so a short-term vacation rental is a commercial use.
Even in a residential zone?
Even in a residential zone.
So if they're in a commercial zone, they're not going to be required to conform to commercial parking regulations.
They're required to conform to the parking requirements that are noted here.
Okay. So, and then my other question would be, knowing, I'm, and again, for residential, I've made my position clear in public, was I'm all for on-site parking for any short-term vacation rental. I think that should be a requirement. My question would be that language, one of the calculation, one for every four, is that going to hold water by the time we get a vacation rental ordinance finished?
If it has to change, we'll change.
You'll change that.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it right now it seems okay because it's based on maximum occupancy, and we'll it's the way that the ordinance is drafted right now, and the way that you've seen it anyway.
Right.
You know, it has the occupancy limitation by bedroom. When you saw it, it was two per bedroom plus two.
Right.
Went through the planning commission, and now it's just two per bedroom. They got rid of the plus two, and there's been some pushback on that. So we'll see where we end up. But that would be a definitive amount based on the bedrooms that are in the house, and we would apply this parking standard to it.
Well, this seems, I'm sorry.
So at some point, for vacation rentals in residential, there'll be language that will clearly state that all parking shall be on the property.
That's what this says.
Okay.
Yeah, I think this is the minimum you could do. I mean, you're not going to have, 10 people coming in one car. And so if you want to really make sure that they take care of their own parking requirements, one for every four, I think, is the minimum you really, should do. I mean, sometimes people will come in three people in a car, and there'll be two cars or six people or something. And so, I mean, I guess that would still be two parking spaces. But anyway, I think this is not, I don't think it's onerous at all. And it's logical.
So then the next section has provisions for parking reductions based on transit accessibility, whether there's parking public parking facilities located within the vicinity. If you provide motorcycle parking, car sharing programs, and shared parking. So those are all opportunities for, based on different characteristics, to get reductions in the parking requirements.
You know, I've noticed in a lot of things I've been reading about affordable housing, and they talk about it being accessible to transit. And now this is the parking reductions if you're close to transit accessibility. Is this to force people, or is this a state law, or is the movement already going that people are using less cars and using more transit? So if you're close to public transit, that's the affordable housing and the fewer parking places is all tied together with that.
Well, the idea is that if you are close to transit service, then there's options for not getting around without having a car. Whereas if I live somewhere away from transit, no matter what, I have to have a car to get around.
I understand that, but I've just been seeing this so often. I was just wondering, was it a state ordinance or something that's coming in, or is it just a policy going to moving towards?
So there is the accessory dwelling unit. State law does, include the transit accessibility.
For accessory dwelling units, for new ones, we don't have a parking requirement for it. We don't have a parking requirement for it because every single lot in town is within a quarter mile of a transit station.
I had a question about the proximate public parking facilities. There's public parking facilities and there's city-owned parking facilities, and we don't really have any, as far as I know, any third-party parking facilities. But it's possible that at some point in the next however many years this is going to be in effect, that there will be some private parking facilities, in addition to perhaps say a public garage or some kind of thing like that. So I think it shouldn't necessarily be limited to city-owned facilities, but sort of going the other direction. If you're talking about hotels or things where the usage will be at night or overnight, there should be a requirement if there's parking waived for that proximity, that parking be available at the times when it's more likely to be used. Does that make sense? If you have a hotel and the hotel doesn't have to put in that much parking because there's a city garage a block away, okay, well, that makes sense. However, let's say the city garage closes at 10 o'clock at night. Well, people going to a hotel are going to be there overnight. Well, it's not necessarily going to be available to them, so the mitigation doesn't really make sense in that case.
Well, and I think that's one reason it requires an approval of a minor use permit, so that those kinds of factors can be taken into consideration. So it's not...
So it's a maybe waived, it's not you automatically...
Right, it's not automatically,
okay.
Yeah.
So okay. Example, we have Rose's Landing, we approved with... they converted the upstairs to 10 units of hotel space, mm-hmm. where that restaurant use is there. By the previous calculations and in the sort of legacy parking thing that was there, they wouldn't be required to provide any parking for it, but they wanted parking. They're like, we have hotel guests. They need a place to park their car. And so they said, hey, city, can we lease space from you? And so we've worked with them to identify space for them to lease from the city, so they're patrons have a place to park their car in the evenings, overnight. So.
Okay, but then that takes away the parking from the public use.
Yes and no. It depends. I mean, you have these lots that can be available for lots of things. We're also saying, hey, on the waterfront, we're not going to require parking for redevelopment.
Right.
We're already doing that. This is allowing us. Hey, they want. We're saying you don't have to have it. You can have your hotel rooms and not have parking spaces identified for them. And they're like, no, we really need that. And we're like, okay, if you want them, you're going to lease them from us, and they'll be from a limited term time basis. And that's the kind of way that project was conditioned. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm not sure about that, but I guess what I'm saying here is. Understanding that it's a may waive and not will waive, it shouldn't necessarily be limited only to city owned parking. It could be any public parking facilities that are available to the public. Like I said, if we ever have a private parking facility, there's no reason why that would be treated differently.
Right, and we could either look at just taking the city out, although the city owned out, although you're still required to provide off-site parking through an agreement, and then there's the option for other parking reductions to where, through a minor use permit, there may be other types of considerations.
I understand that, but I guess I don't see any reason why this should be limited to city-owned parking. Like whoever owns the parking is not as relevant as the fact that it exists and it's available to the public.
Okay.
May I interrupt for a point of order here? Are we going to come back to this at another meeting?
It depends. That's up to you.
Well, I'm just thinking that we've gotten stuck on parking here for so long, and we went past those earlier elements. I didn't know we were not going to come. I thought we were going fast, very fast through them and then coming back.
Yeah.
And so there's a bunch of stuff in those earlier chapters we haven't talked about yet.
Correct.
Sorry. So it can finish up just the whole thing, and then we can go back for discussions. So then the rest of the parking section has things for in-lieu payments, parking management programs in districts, then things on the location of required parking, as well as parking area design and development, requirements for bicycle parking and loading spaces as well. And then the final section is the performance standards, which to a large degree carries forward your existing performance standards, and it has the kind of requirements or limitations in for things that may have a potential to cause a nuisance, such as glare, noise, air contaminants, fire and explosive hazards, and so on. So that is a summary of what's in Module 4, although a longer discussion of parking, and then we can go back through and I can answer any questions that you have on throughout. Oh, that was what really carries forward a lot of what you have existing in your performance standards, and then has the limits and enforcement for all of those individual aspects, including noise, hazards, glare.
So starting back at the beginning, do we have any discussion on overlay districts?
I have a question on the ESHA.
Okay.
On the first page, the applicability, or rather the purpose, seems to emphasize water and all things to do with water, all kinds of land with respect to water. And then on later on page 15, there's a reference to terrestrial. Is it really our purpose to focus the ESHA on wetlands, riparian? Because that's what the purpose reads like to me now.
Right. No, it's all ESHA, whether it's terrestrial or water influence.
Okay. Then there's a statement at some point, I wish I had the page correct here, invasive plant species shall be prohibited. I get the image of somebody putting a citation on ice plant.
Probably, yeah.
So it's agency may be the issue. Who is going to, is this assuming that somebody is planning to put in ice plants somewhere, and we're not going to let them, or what is this?
So that is on page 52, and that's in landscaping. And so, yeah, that would be, you can't include that in your landscaping plan.
All right. What does fuel modification mean?
Which page?
Page, I have it on page, that's under C2. I didn't write the page number down on that one. It's probably in that same vicinity. 15?
Yeah, it's about the middle of page 15. So those are areas where, you know, by requirement of the fire department or so on, that you're required to do some vegetation clearing for fire hazards.
Okay.
So it's fuel, things that would fuel a fire.
Correct.
Okay.
Backing up just a little bit on the cultural resource protection part, for your mitigation, plans should be prepared by a qualified archaeologist, paleontologist, or other qualified expert subject to the approval of the director. That's page 12. I would ask that we include a consultant from the Native American community as well, cultural resource consultant who is Native, if that meets with the approval of people.
Wouldn't that the archaeological sensitive note would not cover that?
Nope. You know, you'll have an archaeologist, but I think you talk with the Native community, and it just depends on your archaeologist whether they are sensitive to what the actual cultural concerns are with a place.
The requirement here is that the archaeologist has to be knowledgeable in local Native American culture. So I'm just wondering, does it have to be a Native American person, or can it be someone who's knowledgeable and has a good background in it?
Often what the state requires is both. So you have an archaeologist and you have a Native consultant.
You want like a culturally affiliated?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
In the preparation for the study?
Right, right. Okay. It's just at the consultation level, and then, you know, as resources come up, there are other requirements anyhow, so.
I'm sorry, but we're specifying sort of an educational background in the culture as opposed to sort of, we're not talking about the ancestral.
I think she is talking about mm-hmm. that. That's why I was thinking it does actually say already the educational.
So the Native American Heritage Commission will identify culturally affiliated persons mm-hmm. that could be consulted in the preparation of an archaeological study, say. And so that's how we would phrase this, is we would say they need to be consulted in the preparation of that report. Mm-hmm. So.
But we wouldn't be specifying any ancestral requirement.
So the culturally affiliated means something specific, and it means if you contact the NAHC, they will identify culturally affiliated folks with this area. It might be Chumash, it might be Salinan, it might be somebody else. And you need to consult with one of those folks. As long as they do that and they bring that forward through the report that they're providing to us, that would qualify them underneath this section if we add it.
Well, that makes sense because it says here that surveys can be conducted by an expert, but but they have to just consult with the other people. So it's not that those people have to do the survey. They simply have to be consulted.
I'm not going to put words in Susan's mouth. The idea here would be to have the consultation happening early on. So when it usually happens is after the report's done, mm-hmm. okay? And after it's done and then it gets let out to the world and it gets reviewed, a lot of times out of context sometimes, the culturally affiliated communities, often Chumash or Salinan, will look at it and they don't like something that's in there. And they take an immediate offense to it and it creates angst and conflict. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it's a bad idea. I think it's actually a really good idea. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Because I think City of San Luis does something like this now as well. I think it's probably a good idea because we're having more and more of those sort of conflicts well down the road. You know, and this might actually solve that up front. I mean, it's something I've been actually thinking about for a while. I just didn't think enough to put it in here, I guess.
I think it helps. In the work that I've done with archaeologists who asked people to be involved ahead of time at the beginning of the process went a lot more smoothly. So,
I mean, I think getting folks in the room together early on mm-hmm. is better. So we don't end up with the fight on our doorstep, which is... Right. Maybe a little self-serving, but I don't like to play referee.
No, it's all good.
Yeah. I don't have to.
So jumping around again a little bit, page 24, there's I'm in the mitigation and monitoring section of the ESHA, and I think the responsibility for mitigation, if I understand it, is implicit in the applicant is going to have to provide suitable mitigation procedures if they want to do something in an ESHA zone or within 100 feet of an ESHA zone. Under monitoring, it's not clear who's going to do it. I think the idea is that under H it would read, the director shall monitor mitigation measures for a sufficient period of time.
So this could mean a couple of, I think this is actually written broadly to pick up a couple of different things. Mm-hmm. Any project that has monitoring requirements in it, oftentimes will have monitoring and reporting requirements that go with it. Say if they have to do habitat restoration or something along those lines, they'll have a time frame within which they need to establish whatever the habitat is to an establishment of 90% typically. And it might be have an initial establishment period of 3 years. Oftentimes with reports every year on the progress. And then that time frame can be extended to say if you were trying to establish wetlands or something like that. And then it's on the city because those are conditions of approval. We're the ones that are required to make sure that that happens and that those reports are coming in on a yearly basis so that we're making sure that the mitigation is being implemented and it's being established again in the instance of a wetland restoration type situation.
Sure, and I understand. I my point is just agency and making sure that it's somebody's responsibility. And it's implicit in places in here. The director shall determine if we need a longer mitigation period or not. But just saying it clearly makes it so, I think.
The director of the city or, you know, some.
Yeah, I don't know who the right person is. Yeah. I assume the director is used in the paragraph below, so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. While we're in this area, on page 25, under the method of protection guarantee, 3C, the offer of dedication. I read that several times and couldn't figure it out. An offer of dedication is made when no public agency, private organization, or individual is willing to accept fee interest or easement, blah, blah. These offers shall not be accepted until maintenance responsibility and liability is established. So what's the point of offer of dedication if no one is willing to accept responsibility? And if nobody accepts, what happens then if nobody accepts?
After 21 years, the offer would expire, 21 years? The offer would expire, I believe.
Wow.
But the idea is that you have the offer and you're making it available, even though if you don't have the ability to take it on right now, maybe somebody over time has the ability or an agency comes up. Or like City didn't have Morro Bay Open Space Alliance for a very long time. Right now we have Morro Bay Open Space Alliance. And so we didn't used to have a body that could take on things like that, take on, you know, things that are being dedicated. But maybe we do now. Right.
So that's what's being referred to.
So
I
yes.
thought it was somebody who was in the process of trying to develop something that they weren't going to take.
No, usually
the responsibility.
Yeah, it's usually just dealt with, you know, dedicated requirements that come out of projects and things like that for preservation of fill in the blank. And they can be dedications of easements. They can be dedications of real property. Used to, when I first started working for the city of Pismo Beach, I went through a research project about all of the offers of dedication that had been provided by development along the bluff top, because we were supposed to have a bluff top trail. And we had several gaps in it. And it turned out that we had 25 maybe, offers of dedication that were sitting out there, and about half of which were going to expire within a year. And so we immediately ran to council and accepted all those offers of dedication so that we could continue the bluff top trail that our general plan says we're supposed to have. So it's things like that. I mean, so while it's a good thing to have, because if we didn't have that, we wouldn't have been able to put those connections in place to connect that some of those bluff top trail areas. And so we were able to do that after accepting those offers of dedication, as an example.
But if you hadn't noticed that, what would have happened when they expired?
They would go away.
And then things could go on there.
Well, things could go in there. I mean, they would come in, and and it's not like history goes away. You have the permits that are there, and they said, hey, this was supposed to be dedicated to the public for public purposes, and now you want to develop it. It was probably dedicated for a reason. Either your general plan said you're supposed to have something here, or it's supposed to be preserved, so they're not going to develop it. It might still be just left undeveloped. Or you'd go, nope, our general plan still says that. No, you can't do it, because it would be inconsistent. That's usually.
So the reason that they had the offer in the first place would still be there, and so probably they would have to offer again or do something
else.
Yeah,
correct. They we want to put, you know, 10 more hotel rooms over there. I'm like, sorry. General plan doesn't allow you to do that. You're supposed to give that property or offer it up so they have to do it again.
Could we have a little discussion on page 36, the table in lieu fees for affordable housing? You have various project sizes and then percent of each unit or fraction thereof. So if say the project size is 5 units and you're not going to put in affordable housing, you're doing some in lieu fees equal to 10% of the cost of each of those 5 units. So in other words, 50%, there's, well, it wouldn't be 50. So
it's 10% of the cost of one unit. Or 10% of
10% of the cost of one unit 5 times. Is that what that means?
10% of the whole.
Right.
Yeah. So what happens is you get one full unit once you get to 10, right? Isn't that what it is?
Yes.
You get one full unit once you get to 10. So yeah, it's 10%.
Okay.
So you get 50% at 5.
Okay.
And you get the money back for 50% for 5. Okay. That was horrible information. I apologize.
What are there incentives for people to? Could we create more incentives for people to do the affordable housing rather than just pay the in lieu fees? So, like, do we say, gee, you're going to put in affordable housing, we are going to, make your fee, your permitting process just go really fast for you, you know, so you can get it done.
Certainly we could, but I find it hard to believe in this day and time that we would be, other than the situation where you can't get to a full unit, accepting cash. I would think that we would be requiring the provision of the housing every time.
Okay. I like that.
We're that short. I mean, it's just and that mindset, I think, for communities, has been changing to that end for a very long time. It used to be pretty common that you'd get in lieu fees, but it's less so now.
Okay.
I still don't get what we just talked about, and I apologize, but I still don't get that whole percentage thing, okay? So for 5 units, you have to, the in lieu fee, assuming you were accepting an in lieu fee, would be 50% of the cost of a unit, because it's 5 times 10%, right? Okay. If you get up to 18 units, how could that be 100%? I mean, 100% of the cost of each unit cost? That doesn't make any sense.
Okay, I'll give you an explanation, because I recently had a project where they were required, and Scott just said we always want the affordable housing and we don't want the cash. So this is a reverse example, because it was approved 5 years ago. But their requirement was to pay 2 affordable units. And the city council said that can either be cash or you can provide a unit, 2.5 units, excuse me. So they said, okay, we're going to provide 2 units. So this is a great example. We actually got 2 affordable units. They will be for sale, and hopefully they will be built and constructed within 6 months. But the half unit, so because it was more than an 18-unit development, I went to our housing element, and I said, you have to pay 100%. So I need a copy of your construction pro forma, and I will vet it, and I will evaluate that you're telling me what it truly costs to build a unit. Now, I don't remember the exact number, but it was $300,000. Let's say it was $300,000 to build a unit. So if someone's building an 18-unit development, and their requirement is to provide 1 affordable unit, and they're going to pay cash, then they're giving the city $300,000.
Okay, so
if they're building a 5 unit,
okay,
then it's 10%. So then they'd be giving us $30,000.
Okay, so this is, it's not 50%. It's not 5 units times 10%.
Yeah.
It's 10% of the cost of a unit.
Yeah. So that,
okay, that's
5
that's
unit
where,
development.
Yeah. So no, that's where. Yeah. No, I didn't.
Yeah.
That sort of went by me. So when you get to 18 units, you have to pay the cost of 1 unit.
1 whole unit.
Okay. All right. Because I think we were getting into multiplication, and then it didn't make any sense when you were getting into higher numbers here. Okay.
It is
Thank
a multiple,
you.
But once you've done it, then it's like, oh yeah, it makes sense. But we need for real hard data to tell you.
Right. And the way you were discussing it made perfect sense. When we were talking about multiplying, going across, it just didn't make sense here.
Yeah.
So it's not the cost of each unit cost. It's the cost of a unit, if that makes sense.
And that's hard cost, that's soft cost, that's everything.
Okay.
What
and is
it
an average cost of a unit?
Well, It could be. Like, so five-unit development, and maybe it's a $1.5 million project, and maybe one unit's going to cost $300,000, and a couple units are two and $400,000. We would divide it. You know, what does that cost per unit? Your five-unit development, it was $1.5 million divided by five. That's $300,000. You owe the city.
Okay, so it's not
that.
So there's not really, let's say some of them are larger units versus smaller units,
yeah,
or any of that. It's not the cost of a one-bedroom unit. It's the cost of an average unit in that
right.
development.
Yeah, and our current housing okay. element doesn't say it's the cost of the most expensive unit. It's just, you know, give us your...
It's the average cost.
Yeah,
okay.
give us your construction
I think that
budget.
Could be, first of all, I think that could be a little more clearly explained here, that it's the average cost of one unit. Okay. This says of each unit cost, and you've got five units, then that was where you were getting the confusion of, well, it's now it's 50% of the cost of whatever. So
yeah.
So I think it's the average cost of a unit in this development,
mm-hmm.
of a single unit. And so I think that would probably clear it up a bit.
And then on the affordable housing, if I was glad to read in here that it has to remain affordable for at least 55 years. Has that always been a deal, or could somebody...
You got a typo in there. It's funny that 55 years is on there, page 35.
Previously, the city's always had it as 30 years for as long as I can remember. It's common practice nowadays that it be 55 years, and we've had some recent projects where we've required them to sign and execute covenants for 55 years.
That's good. Otherwise, people would be buying them and reselling.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, good. That's good.
So...
It's a long time.
I would be, I guess I'm opposed to the in-lieu fees altogether on affordable housing. I would encourage, unless we're required to do this, but think about this. I mean, we're going to get 10, say on one unit, the five units, we're going to get 10% of the cost of one unit. $300,000, your example, would be $30,000. It's going to take us how many years to accumulate enough money that we could contribute to affordable housing to build that unit down the road. In the meantime, say 5 years, the cost of construction goes up. These units are going to cost us a lot more down the road, even when they gave us that money 5 or 10 years ago. Whereas if we require affordable housing, we get it at today's cost, and we get it out into the market where it can be used, instead of sitting on a pot of money and hoping that it'll grow big enough for us to make a difference in town.
I think what this does help with, though, is I've seen contractors in the past who are working on big projects and have this requirement to have affordable housing, and get almost to the end of the project, and now we're out of money, and we never actually built the affordable part of it. So this at least gives you something to hold over their head. Because, you know, if they're saying, I'm out of money, what are you going to do? But if you say, well, here's your contract with the city, you owe us these fees if you're not going to provide that housing. So I suppose at least you get something out of it.
And I would think that we should bond like we do, like when I was overseeing construction project, put a bond in there that ties them to providing that affordable unit when they build it. If they go belly up or they choose to... manipulate the construction to the end and say, oh, gee, I'm out of money, I can't build affordable, there's a bond that we can go after to make sure we get it built.
And I would add that it's standard that we add conditions that's typically built first.
Yeah, first phase.
And the council's always, in past projects, have said, we want you to provide the units. So the example I gave you was they are providing two units. They did make an in-lieu payment to the city, but that's because there was a fractional requirement, so that was odd. There are situations where in-lieu fee payment can be beneficial to the city because it's not a lot of money. Granted, $30,000 is not a lot, but just last month the city council awarded some in-lieu funds to People Self-Help Housing that they could use to renovate an existing affordable housing development in town that hasn't been renovated in 20 years. They use that as local match, and it allows them to be competitive with state tax credit funding. Another example is we've used it to, you know, buy land when an affordable housing developer comes in and they want to provide affordable housing.
I understand so. That you can do that. It's just my thinking is... you get the person in the affordable housing, you require it. And if they have angst about it, there could be a provision that they could appeal to council, and council could allow them to pay in lieu fee. But otherwise, when they come in the door, the standard procedure would be that you provide the affordable housing. Then you get the person that qualifies for the affordable housing with a automatically, then their cash flow gets better. They can spend more money in the city. It affects our sales tax. I mean, the financial revolution of those dollars will go around the city. And instead of waiting for us to build that pot of money to build something down the road, it produces an immediate effect in the life of the person that needs affordable housing, and actually it contributes to our economy.
What is a density bonus?
Thank you.
If you have another comment on it, maybe let's go to that. Your comment on the in lieu fees, and then we'll go to density bonus. Okay. Is that okay?
I don't have a question. I'd like to sort of flesh that out a little bit more. Do we have any sense in terms of what the response is to developers in terms of must build as opposed to in lieu?
Oftentimes they'd like to pay the money.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Depending on how your, but it really depends on how well your the in lieu section is written in how you calculate it. But usually they'd rather pay, and they'd rather have, you know, full cost units, because as they build them, typically as long as the economy is okay, you know, that each one's worth more. So they typically don't like to provide them, but sometimes they do. Sometimes that, you know, they do like to do it, but oftentimes, I mean, at least in the past, I've found that they'd rather pay the fee. It's nice to have the flexibility for both, because the city might be trying to work an affordable housing, larger affordable housing project over here, where we need money to leverage, you know, tax credits for the project, or to pay down or buy, like Cindy said, the property. And so it would be good. In that instance, we might say, oh, yeah, we're okay. We'd rather have money from you because we have some place to put it to leverage more affordable housing. We have a few affordable housing projects in town, senior affordable housing projects, and so they do come along from time to time. And like Cindy was saying, the money that we just allocated to the project on Sequoia allows that to be recast and then redone. And they're asking for money from us, and it wasn't a substantial amount that we gave them, but it allows them to leverage tax credits to make their ability to go get money, because usually when you're doing affordable housing projects, you have to get money from many sources because it's difficult to do them. and so it's nice to have some money in the kitty that we have, you know, there to leverage projects like that, so we can help out those affordable projects that come along. And so there's those things. They oftentimes, rarely do they have all the funding that they need. They never have a single funding source, at least not that I ever see. So.
And yeah. I just want to point out, and Scott and Cindy maybe could maybe give a little background of how this is related to your housing element, because I think this is less of a discussion on zoning than it is for your housing element. But also, if you turn back on page 35, which is B, which is location of inclusionary unit, the developer is required to provide that affordable housing on site. And then if the city determines that it's not feasible based on that detailed economic analysis prepared by a city contracted consultant at the cost of the applicant, then you require it off-site. And then if the city requires even that's not feasible, that's when the in lieu fee is available. So it's also not just you can pick whatever you want. It's really a process that is aimed at, first and foremost, providing it on-site.
So the city could really say, sorry, you're not giving us a good enough reason not to do it. You just have to. Okay.
So density bonus, the question was, what was density bonus? Do you mean the state density bonus law?
Yeah. What does it mean?
So there is a state density bonus law that, depending on the type and amount of affordable housing that you're providing, you are by state law granted certain density bonuses. And you can also also qualify for concessions or exceptions or incentives, which can mean a relaxation of development standards and other things, which the city is then obligated to allow.
So Martha, just define
density bonus without using density bonus in the definition.
So you were would be allowed to build more units than what would be otherwise allowed?
Because of zoning rules or something?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Every zone in the city has a density that's allowed there. Mm-hmm. And so you could build, in it, say, in your residential zone, you can build 10 units, you know, per acre or what have you. They can get a, you know, 10 or 20% increase depending on the affordability ranges in their in the project. And they ask for that, and we're obligated to provide it to them. They can also ask for other things. We need setback exceptions. We want parking exceptions because of whatever, you know. And so they can ask for those, and we're really obligated, short of some specific reasons why we could say no, but you're typically obligated to accommodate those.
And I could say an example of what a density bonus looks like is the senior housing project at Main and Driftwood. That got actually two density bonuses by City Council. So if that appears in scale with the neighborhood and not overly dense, that's actually far more dense than what the base zone would have allowed had it been market rate. It was a percentage amount. I don't know the percentage amount. I think it was more than two units. I think it might have been three or four, or I don't know the number, but it was more.
When you said two density bonuses, you're talking about two options that they had available to take advantage of?
The density bonus, I think 25%, and then there was an additional percentage, but I don't know what the second percentage was.
We are hitting 6 o'clock. Are we okay to go a little over? If people want to, if there's agreement to finish this up?
Fortunately, no. When we notice the meeting and we have the end time, we have to end. We can't continue it forward.
Can we just revisit this at our next meeting, just to finish up any questions or comments people or discussion items people might have?
That might be the area to stop. We have that. Maybe we could show you the zoning map.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Yeah.
So we could. Is there? We have what? Hazards, shoreline protection.
I had a quick question on the turf limitation. Page 52. No more than 25% of the landscaped area may be turf, which I get for, you know, water restrictions and all. But what about as it relates to daycare homes and things like that, where they're required to have a certain amount of outdoor soft space for children? Do you know?
Couldn't they use artificial turf on that?
I don't know.
Save water?
They'd have to have some other surface material there.
Mm-hmm. So there's no conflict that we know of, though?
Not that I'm aware
with
of.
Okay.
Why is turf prohibited in areas less than 10 feet wide?
That I wondered about that, too.
Well, also the idea is to reserve turf for use in areas where it gets used versus just ornamental, and typically a narrow area like that would be, you know,
there's a lot of other options for a skinny thing like that, I think. Okay.
So we'll start with hazards at the next meeting, and then we'll see if we can't get the zoning map a little, give you an example that, or a copy of the zoning map for you to take a look at, too.
Well, we're still in our meeting.
We're still in our meeting.
Do we have?
There's still a record.
Committee member closing comments on the record. One thing I want to throw out there from a conversation with Glenn, putting you on the hot seat a little tiny bit, the question of whether we have been prescriptive enough in some of our, maybe not so much in the zoning stuff, but even in our general, where do we want to be in 20 years? And this is, you know, maybe we have, maybe we're fine. Do we need more specific goals? Do we need to say we want to have a small to mid-size conference center built in 20 years? You know, should we consider addressing something that specific in this? Growth in population, you know, should we say we want to have that goal of hitting our 12,200 mark? So, and again, I'm not saying yes or no, I'm just throwing it out there from a conversation we had. Maybe it's something to think about in the next month. So that was just a comment there.
I'll just, since you mentioned my name, I'll just step in. What I was talking about in that conversation was that from our vision state, we're going back 3 years here, you know, and in the point where we were looking at a vision for what we wanted to have happen, we got a very general picture, which is absolutely consistent across time. Everybody I talk to says the same things. We don't want moral beta change. We want to keep the same small eclectic place it is, only we want to make things better. So that's, we're always trying to fit the square peg in a round hole in a way. But one thing that we didn't do as a group, at least, is talk about at the time in implementing this vision, what specific, do we have any specific goals or objectives for our 25-year horizon? Do we want to stimulate population growth because it leads to some good things? We never had a discussion like that. And I think really the time has passed for it. So, you know, So
you have had some of those conversations, you know, both in the growth section of the general plan. This, all that lives in the general plan, not in the zoning code that we're looking at today. So you have had some of those conversations. Whether you were specific enough in those conversations, I can't answer the question for you. We did take your input. I mean, I think when you saw Plan Morro Bay, I think many of you may have wondered, hey, what are all these background documents and the baseline assessment, all these things? What are these things for and water? What comes out of these? I heard you say that a lot, so that's why I said that. And then when you saw Plan Morro Bay, you're like, oh, that's where it goes. If there are, you know, if you have concerns about what it looks like in that document now, I'd certainly like to hear it before we finalize it. I don't want to hear it when I go to council to have it approved and have GPAC members standing there saying, well, we don't really want that now. And I don't think the council wants to hear that either. So I think if you want to talk about some of those things, you should do so quickly. Because we're probably not going to have a whole lot more GPAC meetings. We're running out of things for you to look at this point. So you guys need to have that conversation amongst yourselves because you've moved Plan Morro Bay on. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I certainly, if you have those concerns and they're bothering you enough to where you'd be voicing those to council members and things like that, then they're significant and we should address them.
Now, let me reiterate. I think we're past the time for some of that kind of discussion. I'll look at the document with that in mind, but it can be sent to you in a memo.
Absolutely, so, yeah. I mean, in fact, it's interesting. We got on Plan Morro Bay at Melanie. I know she's not here, but she provided us several comments. And I had forgotten I'd wanted to do it this week. I wanted to sit down with Cindy and go over her comments so that we can incorporate some of that information. She had some pretty good comments and things that I thought, oh, good idea. Probably should, you know, put that forward before we hit Planning Commission with it. And so if any of you want to do that, happy to take that from you outside of this forum, or if you want to bring it up and talk about it next meeting, I'm fine with that too.
Yeah, I understand what Glenn's saying. I guess for me, with past experience working for a city, and you've probably encountered this too, is that I think, as you know, we've spent 3 years here doing this work, and I think our efforts would be better served if we helped future councils feet to the fire and don't wait this long to do a general plan again. Wait, you know, require, you know, even pushing them for every 5 years, let's look at this and let's see some of the things Glenn's talking about or whatever that we don't know today and make sure that there's money set aside, that we don't have to go begging for grants somewhere, that there's, we have a process in place that we could establish how we go forward. And preserve and protect.
Update process. Something like that.
The general plan is only as good as the ability that we have to update, because it's gonna grow. It's a living document, and we failed. We being whoever was before us for how many years? 20 something years, not doing that. We were left with an onerous task that could have been done a lot easier if we would have helped council to fire and found the money set aside to update on a regular basis. That's my thought.
I think what I see with the plan is it is a blueprint, and it's something for councils, for planning staff to refer to so that as projects come up, we say, well, does it fit? And I think it's a good document for that. And I think with all of our various specific plans for, you know, the downtown redevelopment and the connection between the waterfront and downtown, all of those things kind of hit those specific things. So something to think about.
The good thing, the plan all has all the plans that you just referenced, including Plan Morro Bay, has an implementation section that goes with it.
Mm-hmm.
So we will have specific metrics to how we've been implementing it. Because the general plan that we have right now that exists, there's nothing in there that tells us to do much of anything. Mm-hmm. There are some things in there, but not much. And this has the matrix in the back that says, hey, you're going to go do all of these things. And that's what gets incorporated into our goals process. And, mm-hmm. and then we report back on that when we report.
Every year.
Every year we're supposed to be doing that. And so we'll be reporting on, we'll have those reports come forward because we should be telling folks that we're implementing the plan that we spent $1.2 million on. I mean, that's important. There's a lot of money that came forward, not just in grant funding, but city funds as well. We need to be responsible for that.
Any comments from Community Development Director?
I have one. We have a joint planning and planning commission and WRF CAC meeting on July 3rd. It'll be to review the EIR for the wastewater treatment facility, the proposed. That'll be from 3 to 6 in this building. Then we'll go into our regular planning commission meeting, but it'll be during the 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. time frame.
Will we have a chance to review it ahead of time, the EIR?
This is the EIR for the WRF.
Okay.
Yeah, not EIR for the general plan.
Duh.
Yeah.
All right. Then I think we can adjourn until our next meeting, Thursday, July 19th, here at the Veterans Building.